Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and streaming of primo local content. Download the accessmedia.nz app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to a show. Now, we have three guests tonight, and I'm about to look over my shoulder. So it is Matt Shepherd, Sylvia Otley, and Luke Geddes, and they are from the Otago RCE for Sustainable Development, and we'll talk about what that is, because that's quite complicated and there's lots of partners.
And it's
quite very exciting development here for Otago, with a centre of excellence here. So, Sam, do you want to talk to us a bit about what the structure is, and then we'll talk to our guests?
Okay. The recently announced Otago UN, as in United Nations, Regional Centre of Expertise for Sustainable Development, has got a cumbersome title. Mm-hmm. A short one will be found, that's not an acronym. But it's very exciting. So it means that we are being recognised as one of 170, I think they told us today, centres around the world of people who are really focusing on education for sustainability. So the Polytech is the, I think it's referred to as the host, the universities involved, all the mayors, all the councils are involved, all the places, lots of Orokonui type places are involved, and quite a lot of places, or quite a lot of industry type places, the economic development places, the tourism places like Wanaka Sustainable Tourism or whatever it's called, all those sorts of places are involved. And so we had the first, it was launched, well, it was announced like 2 or 3 weeks ago. And today was the first sort of full day workshop to actually put the structure together. So it's got as helpful as people here with me. It's got five working groups. Actually, I was thinking that there's five almost sort of subject area, three subject area working groups, which is the tourism, towns and cities, and
education,
water,
yeah.
And then education and partnerships are ones that sort of sit over those. So it's, and the education one is education in its own right, but also education across the thing. And then a really important one, which is also sitting over all of the others, is the youth working group. And we have three of the members of that here today.
Well, that's absolutely fantastic. I mean, one of 170 around the world, that is pretty impressive that we got that here in Otago. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and they were particularly impressed with the approach that we took in terms of the partnership, but in particular the partnership with Kaitahu, and that's a true partnership, not just sort of an add-on. They're recognising that as being something quite significant. And, of course, the involvement that we have with the young people.
And how did it actually come about? How did we win this, or how did we achieve this great...
A very large application that Barry Law led, developing it through last year. The application sort of has to come from the community, but with a nominated partner. And of course, how that works is that the nominated partner ends up doing quite a lot of the work to pull it all together. and we first looked at it about 10 years ago, and it just wasn't going to fly because we hadn't got those sort of the partnerships properly established. I don't know if you remember, at the time the university wasn't interested at all. So thank you for getting them, well, getting them on board.
I did my small part there.
getting the university moving very much in that direction. And so it's a very much about pulling all those things together, and It's very much, as we'll talk about, very much a sort of action-focused, what's it going to take to not just talk about this, not just do education for the sake of it, but how can we use education to help drive forward all of those other change things that we need.
That's fantastic. So we'll talk to our guest now. So we'll start off with Sylvia. And so Sylvia, if you tell us about this, this is a big thing. This is a really big deal. I mean, and yep. we've had a lot of talk about, you know, with climate marches recently and Greta Thunberg. And so I kind of just want to get an idea of what, how is it that you got involved? And we'll, I'll ask the same question of all three of you. So, but unfortunately, you get to answer the question first. So how did you get involved with this? And you know, where do you go to school and that kind of thing? So
So I'm year 13 in, at Otago Girls High School. And my principal approached me to at becoming representing our school as a student leader at the one of the first meetings in Cromwell for this last year, where I went along to. And after that, I just kept on going to the meetings. And then end of last year, I was approached by Barry to be a youth representative and a youth leader. But my principal approached me through my previous involvement in programs such as the Town Bout Kaitiaki, where an enviro schools at my school, and just sort of sustainable or environmental groups and so, projects that I'm involved with.
Cool. So explain to us what enviro schools are, because we have a lot of international listeners who won't be familiar with what enviro schools are.
So. So we have an enviro schools group at our school. Enviro schools is a... I'm not quite sure how wide they
Most schools are involved with it.
Quite a lot of schools are involved. So there's someone from enviro schools, the... who comes and facilitates and helps us with whatever we may wish to
What kind of projects would you do at school for that?
So as an example, last year enviro schools were applied and were able to get funding for these worm bins, so hungry bins, to help with waste issues at our school, waste management and minimisation. So we've implemented two at our school, and we've got two more that we've just built this week, actually, that we're going to hopefully get out next week.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, fantastic.
And what's the Town Bout Kaitiaki?
So Town Bout Kaitiaki is something as a... It's not, what's the definition? It's a group of students and from early childhood to high school that sit under a strategic leadership group. So there's a strategic leadership group and a student leadership group who... it's a student-led initiative to achieve whatever we'd like, really, that there are schools around. I don't know. Luke can pitch in a second.
Okay, so Luke, come in to the mic now. So tell me what school you went to, how did you get involved, and... what kind of projects, you know, you're involved with Sylvia?
So I'm a student at Otago Boys High School, and originally getting into this regional centre of expertise for sustainability, I got into it through the Waterwise Untouched World Foundation camps facilitated by Barry Law, and I've also got into this through my involvement in Town Bout Kaitiaki as well. And this probably has piqued my interest in sort of sustainable thinking, which makes me very excited for what's to come.
Okay. And what was the Waterwise campaign about? What was that about?
Waterwise is a series of leadership camps run by... the Untouched World Foundation, and of which Matt is involved in, but
you can jump in if you want to help out as well.
They're all trying to fob off their answers
to someone else.
I can probably help on that one. The Untouched World Foundation is really an organisation trying to build leaders for a sustainable future. We run a range of programs up from reaching all the way up to Northland, through the Marlborough Sound, Christchurch, and then down in here in Otago. The Waterwise program that Luke went on was my first encounter with the Untouched World Foundation as well. And it's really about trying to understand all the aspects of water in Otago, how we use it, where it comes from, the problems around it. And through that, we try and facilitate sort of quite difficult discussions on where we want to go a bit more in the future and how we can control that water.
Yeah, and these sort of camps do sort of encourage critical thinking and sustainable thinking and thinking on a wider perspective, wider than just your own personal view on water, but also encouraging you to think inclusively about how other people can use a resource that is important as important as water.
So what led you to go on a camp like that?
Honestly, it was a very exciting opportunity that first presented to me when I saw the applications were open for it, and it exceeded all of my expectations in terms of both building on my personal interactive skills and talking to people, but also learning an awful lot about our own water issues in Otago and both the political and social sides of the debates as well.
Well, how many kids will be going on those? How many were in your groups?
Water-wise?
Yeah, water-wise, yeah.
So water-wise camps usually are probably about 15 to 30 students, of which are made up of tertiary and secondary school students as well as a few leaders. And it's a very good mix of those two groups, and both sides build on their leadership skills, being able to take charge and have the opportunity to teach, learn and discuss important issues.
Well, that's fantastic, Matt. So tell me about your involvement and role here.
So my involvement in the RCE really started probably a couple of years ago when I first started working with Barry Law. The same way I got into the Untouched World Foundation through one of these WaterWise programs. I've now been a part of four, maybe five Untouched World Foundation programs and are fortunate enough to be board member of the foundation as well after the couple of years of hard work. And Barry really got us involved in this as some youth that were quite happy to stand up against some senior figures in Otago who had very set plans on things that they wanted to do and challenge them on how we wanted things to be for our future. And it's just been a really exciting opportunity, and we all came together for the first time today to really sort of start to express our opinions and ideas. And I felt like they didn't fall on deaf ears for one of the first times that we've been at these meetings, and very constructive.
So that sounded a bit political. So what, could you explain that bit more about talking to these other people?
Yeah, sometimes I feel because this was the first time that we've really managed to bring together sort of political leaders, business leaders, cultural leaders all into the same room. And we were a bit worried that there would be a bit of clashing between some of those and that the youth would fall a little bit to the side piece like they have done in the past. And we've got a really good, strong set of leaders here. And Luke and Sylvia really showed that today by managing to stand up. And what we said really today was that we don't want to be the token youth voice, that we just want to be another seat at the table. And we're trying to move away from that token youth and rather be the youth that needs to be listened to, in the same way that we've sort of been way more inclusive of the cultural understanding of where we need to go with these things.
So Matt, how did you get involved with this? You got involved like five years ago, did I understand?
About 3 years ago, I first got involved with the Untouched World Foundation.
And so how did that come about?
Ask him what degree he's got.
Oh, what degree?
I have an honours degree in geography.
Geography, woo-hoo! Of course. Yeah. It's geography.
No, I first got involved in this through the amazing Caroline Hepburn-Dool up at Knox College. She's the deputy master up there. She's been running the Untouched World Foundation WaterWise program now for probably,
I think this was her
fifth or sixth year, but she's run a program in other places before this. And as a member of that college, she then got me involved in coming on this program. And it really inspired me to keep working in the sustainability field. It was you come together and there's no hierarchy and we're all trying to help each other facilitate and learn. And it's an amazing sort of experiential learning experience, something that you don't get in the very formal education sector. And I think it really sort of grasped me and helped develop my learning.
Do you think you could unpack the balance between the subject area that got your interest, but also the the approach? It sounds like it's a bit of both.
Yeah, the subject area for me and my focus is around climate change. I have a real passion for climate change and science and understanding the theory behind it. But my main reason for doing that was to validate my arguments in the sustainability field. I was fortunate enough to go to Paris a couple of years ago to represent the Untouched World Foundation in New Zealand at the UNESCO World Youth Conference on Education for Sustainable Development. And that really highlighted to me the need to be able to back up those facts that you come out with around climate change. And there's lots of stories and news that comes around with some fake news and all these random facts. But by being able to go to those arguments with valid scientific proof, I really felt that opened up my arguments.
I'm going to talk now. Let's talk to it now. It's interesting you talk about scientific proof and coming in with the facts. Facts are taking a bit of a battering at the moment.
They are.
What's your take on that as a younger person?
I think it's the ability to go to those conversations with the ability to critically think and systems think. And facts are proven and disproven by scientists all over the world. And it's the line of thinking that I think some people sometimes get lost on. And for my geography degree, that's what it gave me, was the ability to sort of critically assess the situation which we were talking about or the problem we were talking about, and try and prove to people that, yes, things are happening, like the climate is definitely changing, but making sure that it's sort of understandable by whichever audience we were talking to.
And it's often the older audiences who don't seem to understand or accept the facts, you know. I mean, have you found there's a big generational gap yourselves? I mean, do you see any of your own peers denying climate change, or
to an extent, there's always been and probably always will be a generational gap between generations. But personally, I think it's been very encouraging. Some of the older generations, how they have accepted and jumped on the back of a lot of these movements. And, you know, it is hard sometimes accepting that things aren't what they used to be. And I personally have to, the majority of the population have jumped on the back and really, really expressed their views well and changed their views. And, yeah, you have to credit them with that.
Mm. That's good. That's really good to hear.
But you must have friends that think, whatever, my life's going to be about a big car and...
Yeah, there will be everyone. And it's simply just a lifestyle thing that people... Mm. Some people are willing to put themselves ahead of a climate movement that is gaining traction, and more people are choosing to live more sustainable lives than perhaps their parents would have 15, 20 years ago. But hopefully, you know, this climate movement just keeps on going on and gaining more traction.
How does it feel like, I mean, get Sylvia in here as well to talk. So how does it feel like to you guys? I mean, the thing is, I mean, I remember when Sam will back me up, like when we were growing up, it was nuclear weapons. I mean, the real fear for us growing up was, you know, nuclear war, and you know that was a reality for us. And what's it like for you to see the climate, you know, have climate change as this huge existential threat to our civilization, and seemingly people aren't seeming to do anything about it or not do enough? How does that make you feel?
Well, it definitely makes you quite scared, and I mean, there's quite a lot of anxiety around that I know myself and quite a few peers and young people, and as well as older people, experience. But what's really motivational and what's really good is seeing all of my peers, well, not all, but a lot of peers around me and a lot of young people, and as well as other generations coming and binding together, all sorts, you know, young and old, lots of diversity with age and ethnicity and all sorts of things coming together with the determination to help save our Earth.
And do you think that's really important that you have the diversity of views and perspectives there to help come up with the solutions?
Yes, I think it's really important that we listen, that everyone's open-minded and everyone, or that we are able to listen and hear from lots of different people, especially the Indigenous people. And there's quite a lot of youth being listened. Well, there's important of youth, but there's also the Indigenous side and all sorts of diversity that needs to be heard.
I think you raised a really interesting point, though, there when you said you were growing up around the whole issue of nuclear weapons and how that started to build momentum in dealing with those problems. And we talked about it today that part of the issue we face as youth and anyone battling climate change, sustainability, is it's really hard to see climate change, like in real time. We were talking about the films Chasing Ice and Chasing Coral earlier, who are really good adaptations of being able to witness climate change actually happening. But it's really hard for people to grasp onto a concept that they can't see happening, and their only understanding of it is either what David Attenborough shows them on TV or what they hear through the news. And I think that's still a bit of the issue we're facing in trying to convince everyone to do everything they can to improve their sustainability and the way they live, because they're really struggling to actually see it. And because they can't see it, some people are a little bit more hesitant than they should be.
Do you think the recent fires in Australia, especially the smoke from those fires, in the skies of Otago, I remember waking up New Year's Day, seeing this terrible orange glow in the sky and realizing it was smokes from Australia. And do you think that was might have been a wake-up call for people? Were people talking about that?
I think that definitely was a wake-up call, that things like that do happen very close to New Zealand. There is an imminent threat all of the time, especially in an environment that we live in the South Island. It's full of trees, it's full of bush, it's the perfect tinderbox if it needed to be. And it just comes back to the sad thing about the media again, that Australia is still burning, and it's still burning at pretty much the same rate as it was before Christmas, but the media has now been saturated with other prominent issues around the world, and I don't think any of my friends would quite know what was still going on in Australia. They'd assume that it was all fine. And I think that's, again, still a little bit of the problem with people, that when you aren't able to witness the event every day or see it, then it's a lot harder to believe it unless you were there. And I mean, to anyone that's listening, look out at the Australian bushfires right now. If you go online, they're still burning around Cairns all the way down south in Canberra at pretty much the same rate as they were. They're still the highest level of energy emergency warnings. But we just don't read about it in the news anymore. I wouldn't find an article anywhere.
Except the places that are flooding. But that's kind of like it's a difficult challenge when the thing is the sort of environment, weather patterns, and it's quite easy to dismiss. And people, what's this climate change thing? It's quite cold today. Or it's really hard to get people past that. As I was thinking, Shane, you're talking about the growing up and the threat of the nuclear. Remember, did you ever get taken to see that movie?
The day after. Yeah, that was. I remember having nightmares after watching that.
Yeah,
that was a really scary movie. It was like. You'd probably laugh now at the special effects, you would. But it was really brought home just how awful the after effects of a nuclear war would be.
And I don't know what impact that had, because we were too young then to do anything about it.
That's true.
And the Cold War ended itself, although there's still an awful lot of nuclear weapons out there. And what I'm wondering is, what would it take to get that level of scared people now, and would that in fact be a good thing? Does everybody need to be scared witless by that kind of thing? Do people need to be scared witless by climate change?
Well, I suppose a lot of people are kind of arguing that being fear is actually paralyzing, and you feel that you can't do anything. How do you?
You guys scared?
Are you scared?
I would personally say that I'm scared about what could possibly happen at the rate that things are changing from a science background, but I don't know. What about you two?
I personally, you've always got to feel a level of fear, but you've also got to be realistic and say, I don't want this fear to get the better of me, because the worst way to do nothing is to be so scared that you do nothing. So you do have to monitor that level and be aware of the dangers, but also be aware of your footprint and what you can do to change that.
That's courage, isn't it? I mean, it's like, you know, it's no bravery. It's not, there's no courage in doing something when you feel no fear. Mm. It's when you feel fear and you understand, okay, I still have to do this thing.
Yeah.
That's courage, and that's what you're describing. You're describing courage. So, yeah, so you're doing well. You guys are, it's brilliant. So tell us a bit about today. What was it like today? What's the structure? So when, you know, you arrived this morning, what time do you guys arrive at?
And about 9 o'clock this morning.
Okay, and just kind of take us through the day. Take us through what happened, Sylvie. Come on, Sylvie.
Well, we had an introduction, and we went around the room and introduced everyone so that we were able to, I don't know. Yeah, and then we talked a bit about how the being granted and being approved by the United Nations University meant, and some of the things they expected of us now that we're approved by that. And we got into our working groups. So there was the quality education, tourism, sustainable cities and towns, water quality, and partnerships. And we spent quite a lot of time in those groups talking about what it means, what we can do, what our role is, and all that sort of stuff.
And how were those groups composed? I mean, how did you compose them? Was it just people from each? So there's the working groups, and then there's the representative groups as well. So the youth wing, was there other, what other groups were there?
So the youth was spread out, or from what youth we did have, we spread it out between the groups, in which one we felt we could be involved in for now. Yeah,
the five working groups were really selected based on challenges that Otago faces.
Mm-hmm.
And they were sort of industry leaders or mayors that came into certain aspects. And then the youth of us that were selected to join this program were sort of, we sort of put ourselves in our groups. We weren't told where to go. We sort of followed our own interests. I think we were partially selected based on our different interests, in that we would be able to cover all the sort of the gaps in the groups. And there were six of us there today, and we're not saying that's going to limit the number of youth that are going to be there. We as youth think that the more youth that are at the table, the better the conversation is going to be. But it was just, we're sort of really constructive talking about the values of the RCE, the values of the working group, and interventions that we want to make.
So when the working groups come together, I mean, are you deciding the principles? Are you deciding on actions? What kind of, you know, what is the substance of those working groups, and what are you doing with them?
Well, first of all, really, within the working groups and the topics, you really just need to see what can we improve at the moment. What is Otago as a province struggling with? And so then from that, once you go through the basic sort of solving a problem, and so we're currently only at the basic stage of identifying problems and possible.
So you're kind of doing a stock take and understanding exactly where we are, which is
The stock take is definitely the key thing that came out of most working groups, and that the partnership groups run by Monique Kelly has really been focusing on, was what is already there, what's not there, and what can we do.
She's doing some really interesting work in mapping the system. Mm. So it's very much taking a sort of systems approach to who's doing what across the region, and how do we make sure that we're getting the maximum leverage and benefit of those connections.
Is there a particular framework that you guys are using to, you know, structure the working groups and the systems, or?
Not really. The working groups are no, the working groups are pretty autonomous on how that's working. There's sort of a heavy dose of thinking about what sort of sustainability are we going for. Particularly, the business people kept saying environmental sustainability, which was, you know, quietly irking some of us, and correcting them every time we got a chance to quietly get them thinking a bit sort of bigger than that, into a In fact, I heard two people say, without me prompting them, socio-ecological today.
Wow.
That was pretty exciting. Well, it was for me because I'm a geek on those sorts of things. But the Sylvia missed out an important part of the morning, which was the talk of before we did the working groups. There was a bit of discussion about what we were trying to achieve in terms of we're not just doing education for the sake of it. It's about behaviour change. And someone did a really good talk on that. Go, Matt.
Yeah, well, I guess I was sort of thrown in the deep end. Yesterday, Barry asked me just to give a sort of a 15-minute spiel this morning on behaviour change, very similar to the talk that I gave when I went to Paris to talk to the other world leader, like youth world leaders, and how most of this just comes down to, and any activity that we choose to do with the RCE or any intervention we plan to make is all around really creating behaviour change and. How can we get people to engage and change in the long term rather than just getting involved in an action that they're involved in for 3 to 4 months and then not really fulfilling it for the future and for the foresee. And I really just sort of used the concept, which was quite cool to see people using by the end, is something I call the head, hands and the heart, in that you need all three of those to make long-lasting change. So you need the ability to... You need the understanding of the concept. You need the understanding of an idea. So that's what I call the head. You need the ability to undertake an action. So that's what I call the hands, like it's the actual doing thing. But you also need the connection. You need a belief system inside of yourself to actually connect with a problem. And without that belief and the empathy for a problem, you don't really connect to it. And without that connection, we're not seeing people make long-term change. And all of the activities that we plan to do are going to involve elements of all three of those in order to change sort of people's behaviour and whatever it is through any of those five working groups moving forward.
And so the education group, for example, took those, expanded them out a bit, and then looked at the difference of the targets of education. So the obvious targets, like you know, school starting at early childhood through tertiary, but then including work and lifelong learning and so on, but also looking at, okay, so there's also, we could look at community groups or government groups or businesses, and then to say, okay, if for anything that we do, so it might be the water quality group, if we take the principle that everything is an opportunity for learning, mm-hmm. how do we say, okay, you're trying to do this thing about improving water quality, right, there's educational opportunities in there, both to help accomplish that, but also while you're doing it, you might be learning something else. And so the education group worked up a framework for using as a lens for the projects that everyone else is doing. And other groups are working up similar sorts of frameworks today. So I think it's going to be really exciting as those things come together.
So if we go through the three of you, which groups were you on, Luke? What group were you involved with? Working group?
So I mainly worked with the people interested in water use, and so that included the Otago Regional Council, Central Otago Regional Council representatives, and we also had input from Federated Farmers as well. So okay. A wide ranging group.
And what issues did they were raised, or is it, you know, was there anything surprising that you found out?
Not really surprising. I believe everyone is very reasonable, and they talk both from their perspective but also in a wider perspective, showing understanding towards other people's perspectives, which I think is a good thing.
And do you feel that they had a good understanding or handle on the issues around water? Did you feel like they understood it?
Yes, definitely, because obviously at the moment we have big political issues surrounding water permits, especially in Central Otago, where currently the old mining rights are well outdated in terms of numbers, but still everyone wants to retain their use of water for the betterment of their livelihood. But also I feel that they also understood the perspective that we can't continuously have the right to use all of the water from a stream or a creek, and so there they they understand what they need and they want to further their own benefits, but they also understand that other people also need to have a say in the issue.
And what's the state of water in Otago? Is it bad? Is it good? Is it mixed?
Compared to other countries, you know, Otago is very blessed with the quality of water we have and the amount of water we have. But in, you know, the likes of central Otago, the one of the driest regions in New Zealand, you obviously have a water shortage, and so it is a precious resource in that sense that not everyone can have what they want, and so you need to come to a compromise.
And we grow a lot of fruit there, don't we? Yeah, yes, lots of vineyards.
We do. Central Otago is one of our...
Lots of precious, precious vineyards.
Yeah. There's been some interesting cases, and I think it was North Canterbury this week. I was heard on the news arguments about people saying that it's their water right, and the response being, well, you can't have a right to use water that isn't there.
Mm. Exactly.
Good argument, that one. Good
one. And water belongs to everyone, essentially. Now, Sylvia, so what group were you involved with?
I sat mostly with the quality education group.
And how did that go?
It was really good. So there was quite a few different people sat there. There was Otago Girls High School, Otago Uni, Otago Polytech, and...
Some others.
Off the top of my head, I've forgotten. So it was really interesting to see what they thought of, but we spent quite a lot of time trying to unpack what it meant to be the quality education group and what our role would be.
Did you find anything surprising, or did you see, oh, that's a really great idea? Or... You can say
it was really interesting, but
nothing too exciting. Right.
It was exciting, but not. I don't
know. Did you feel that the leadership understood, had a good grasp of what sustainable, you know, education for sustainability is? And
yes and no. We were still trying to. We still had a degree. They had a good understanding of sustainable education, but it's just about one trying to understand how our group, our working group, is going to contribute to that with working with the other groups or working by ourselves as the working group.
There's that tension of, is it about the sustainability of the schools,
mm-hmm.
or is it about, you know, how to enable and empower everything else? And both of those things need to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it gets a bit political after a while, like, because it always boils down to politics, isn't it?
That working group is being led by your principal.
Yes.
Wow.
Whose name escapes me? Linda
Miller. Linda Miller. Miss Miller.
Linda Miller. Wow.
Miss Miller. Miss Miller.
And so is she an inspiring principal?
Yes, it's love.
That's worth several percent on your...
it's... Yep.
Yeah. Distinctions all around.
Do you think that the school is... the Are you seeing this stuff happening at school?
Yes, I think Otago Girls High School has a great environment for... I mean, there's always room for improvement, but currently I've found it a really good environment for enabling sustainability and enabling students to lead in that area, especially myself. I've been given so many great opportunities to lead, and I find that Miss Miller and people around school, teachers and students, have quite a strong sustainability focus.
Well, that's great. That's really good. And look, so what group are you involved with?
I was in the low-carbon cities and towns group, and we were really just trying to dissect what it was meant by low-carbon cities and towns. We were a group made up of the Mayor of Dunedin, Aaron Hawkins, various other people from the DCC, the Blue Skin Resilience Trust, myself, and another name escapes me. Maybe that was it. Anyway, we tried to break down what we thought were the things that we could work towards as a working group using the skills that we had, and we sort of pinpointed three areas in the Otago region that we wanted to work on. One being clean energy homes. So the Blue Skin Resilience Trust have done some great work on this already, building climate safe houses that effectively give off no carbon, are very low cost, low energy. and something that they're hoping to upscale as a possible RCE project for us to undertake.
Mm-hmm.
The second one was around waste. Finn Boyle at Otago Polytechnic has the most amazing organic waste breakdown composting system set up that takes in a lot of waste from all over Dunedin. I think he received $120,000 in funding over the last year in order to build this big sort of composting type, reusing the food to put on the soils and the open gardens that they have around Polytech. The demolition waste was something that else that came up around the Cadbury's factory about to be taken down. Where's all that waste going to go? Can some of it be repurposed? Is it all just going to go to landfill? We hope not, but there were some cynical people in the group that believe it all will do. And then finally, transport, of course. Transport's the one that always comes to mind when people are talking around lowering the carbon use and trying to decarbonize a town or a city.
And did you talk about what gives you the most bang for buck when you're trying to decarbonize a city? Or did you talk about that?
We didn't really delve into that today. I'm sure that's a conversation that will be delved into at a future point. We were really just trying to, and I speak for sort of all the working groups here, put some early ideas down on paper. It was our first proper workshop as a group. The next one's in about 10 weeks' time. So we hope to meet within our working groups once or twice before then to really start to firm on some of these projects. And
you had the mayor of Central Otago in that group as well.
The mayor of Central Otago, yes.
Cadogan?
Yes. Yeah. That's
well done.
And obviously, you know, Aaron Hawkins is a Green, so a Green party member and Green mayor of Dunedin. So what was the Central Otago mayor like? What was his attitude towards? Was he accepting or was he?
I think everyone in the group was there for the common good. I don't think we were trying to do anything that was too politically biased. I don't think we were trying to do anything that was going to push anyone in the wrong direction. We were all sort of looking at current small-scale projects that have proven themselves, that their models now need to be sort of developed and enhanced and scaled up.
Okay.
So I wouldn't say that we had any clashing of heads within the group. It definitely was everyone was there for the common good. I'm not saying when we get to some ideas further down the track that some people may agree and some people may disagree, but I think that's all part of trying to look at everything sustainably and wholly, including economic, social, and the environment. And there will be people that...
That compost one's quite a good example of the Finn's compost thing, that he could have picked a more efficient machine, but it wouldn't have had the learning benefits. So he's still getting the same processing done, but it's going to take a bit of human input to make it work. And that one was chosen, and he managed to convince people to fund it, to fund this one, which is apparently less efficient, but it's got these learning benefits as well. And so it's not necessarily a trade-off, but it's how can we get win-win out of these things. I've got some questions to end with, and we're not going to ask everybody every question, so feel free to chip in. Does anybody have a go-to definition of sustainability?
To me, sustainability is sometimes misconceived as everything to do with the environment. And I think often that the socioeconomic sustainability concepts are not quite as well taught or come across. And that really for something to be sustainable, it's got to be sustainable for the people that do it. It has to be sustainable in terms of economics. If there isn't any money behind these projects, we can't do them. But it also has to be sustainable in terms of the environment. Like we need that planet to still be there to keep doing these things. And without all three of them, I don't think we should really call anything sustainable if we're not focusing on all three at the same time.
You look like you're going to add something to that one.
Oh, no, just, yeah. I think Matt's covered that pretty well, but yeah, to be sustainable, as we need to say, it needs to be there for us in the present, in the future, and 100 years, 1,000 years down the line. And yeah.
What's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years? Yeah, it's your turn.
Come on. What's your biggest success? Come on. You've had lots.
That's pretty broad. Like, do you mean in terms of...
Just pick one.
Anything.
I guess a big success was being involved in the starting up of Taumbelt Kaitiaki and getting to see the leadership of all my peers and people from even early childhood centres getting to take leadership and learn and be involved in that sort of environment.
Yeah, that's impressive. That's really, really good.
You want the pigeon?
Yeah, on the Taumbelt Kaitiaki front, it's very, very rewarding seeing 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds in the town belt during with their early childhood centres, with their primary schools, contributing to cleaning, planting, and weeding and learning within this environment that we have within our very city centre that is our very own piece of bush that is on our back doorstep.
I'd say my biggest sort of success and the thing that I find so rewarding is looking back at some of the students that I've mentored over the last few years and seeing them now at university studying environmental management or geography, challenging local groups. Some of them are now sitting on sort of local youth councils. And to me, that's sort of the most rewarding thing. And my biggest success is now seeing them having come out of their shell when...
So we're writing a book of these conversations. We're calling it Tomorrow's Heroes. So looking back in 20 years, we're pleased those people did this good work. So you're in the mansion. What's your superpower? I want a real one, not laser eyes.
What's my superpower? Oh, God.
I'd almost say just being able to logically argue, debate, and discuss issues with anyone and everyone, to be able to both understand their perspective but also to help bring their perspective, either a compromise or help their perspective become maybe a more positive view if that isn't the case.
That's a good superpower.
Yep. Good superpower.
Oh, I think my superpower would be the ability to run anywhere so I wouldn't have to drive everywhere. Oh, the cost of my car is killing me at the moment, so I think it'd be better if... or free limes, that would be it.
Running with ease, though, not running, getting to.
Yeah.
Oh, superpower. I'm blank, sorry.
All right, we'll come back to you on that one. Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
No. I consider myself to be a facilitator of the conversation. I don't think that I'm actively there to be what I see as an activist out there, like marching. I'm very much more behind the scenes. I'm facilitating the conversations and trying to have the sort of the boardroom tables on why do we need to do this, and understanding the science behind it, and then facilitating that to people rather than... I wouldn't call myself an activist. I'd call myself a facilitator.
I'd have to be in the same boat as Matt there. I wouldn't call myself an activist. I'd more call myself a thinker, someone leading a group and helping them, facilitating them to reach a logical view to what everyone perceives to be right.
I guess I'm a mix. I'm trying to be a bit more of an activist and trying to speak up and be more of a leader for people, especially in my school, to be able to, I guess, help show them and like express my thoughts to them. And but I also am like them and in the background trying to facilitate with groups and things. So yeah, I guess it's a mix.
So what motivates you? You could easily not be doing this stuff. Why do you do it?
I guess I touched a bit earlier before, but something that really motivates me is my peers being as determined and having so much energy, or lack of energy, but like being so determined to help fight for what they believe in and fight for our Earth. But on the more negative side, there's also the things that motivate me, which is like the lack of action, the lack of governmental action worldwide for some stuff, and yeah.
I'd say I was. What motivates me is what the world that my children will see, and the children and their children will see. I have a huge passion for animals, and we're starting to see some of the animals that I've grown up with become extinct all over the world, and I would love them to be able to see that. And I think that's what sort of really motivates me to get involved in climate change and sustainability, and really sort of maintain what we've got now, and hopefully it'll be there for them when they come around in however many years that may be.
Yeah, I think personally it's just the fact that I have an ability to make a difference, and I am in a very privileged position. There aren't many people, many youth in the Dunedin Otago area that are able to sit on the Regional Centre for Expertise, and so the privilege to be on that motivates me to not squander the opportunity that I have and the opportunity that I've been given.
That's good. You got a thought of a superpower yet?
No.
Okay, I'll come back. I'm not letting you away with that one. What's the biggest challenge you're looking forward to?
Someone else. I need to think of my superpower.
my biggest challenge that I look forward to in every conversation is when someone tries to completely disagree with either climate change or why they need to improve their sustainability. And to me, it comes back to every little difference makes a difference. And that no matter whether you believe in it or not, like, temperatures are rising and carbon is increasing. So it's not going to hurt you by reducing your carbon intake. And I love having those challenging conversations with people, and really the ones that don't want to engage. And when you see them engaged is really the challenge that I like to.
I know you have friends who don't believe in this stuff.
Do you?
Do you actively engage?
Do I actively engage? I do like to actively engage with my friends on these topics. Most of my friends are pretty forthcoming on having these like interesting arguments. I'm sure maybe a couple of years ago at university they wouldn't, but now we're all moving towards the end of our university careers and moving out into the big wide world. Then, yeah, people are quite happy to engage in these.
I'm still going on challenge.
Challenge personally is just making a difference, seeing a change, because every small change leads to a bigger change, and it's the domino effect really, that if you can push one domino, then hopefully we can see bigger and bigger change, people becoming more and more aware. And I think, you know, it is a massive challenge, but once you light the fire, it's pretty hard to stop it.
Good on you. Why don't I talk there? Kill two birds with one stone. Superhero power and challenge. So I guess a superhero power would be to be able to voice so many more people in the conversations, especially youth, like getting everyone's voice heard at the places where all these decisions are being made that cause systemic changes. And so I think that's a challenge in itself, is getting those voices there and getting people to listen. And I think a big challenge for everyone is being able to have an open mind, being able to listen and not just speak and not just brush people aside, but having that time to listen and contemplate and try and change and challenge their own thoughts and their own opinions.
And probably having the capacity to admit that you're wrong.
Yes,
if you're expecting
definitely.
Other people to admit it.
Yep.
So if you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would you have happen? And if you don't believe in miracles, the less miracle version of that is, what's the smallest thing that we could do that would make the biggest possible impact?
Ooh. The smallest part. I think just have the conversation.
Yeah.
I think if you don't understand why we need to do what we need to do to sort of future-proof the planet, then have that conversation. And it's not difficult just to turn to the person next to you and ask them, well, why do you think this is? And we're so fortunate in the world that we've grown up in as youth that we have the internet available. So that's our place to go and ask questions. But just ask the question. And I think that's the smallest thing that we can do to really help solve this problem.
I think personally, it's just, really just being able to reach people that perhaps wouldn't be able to engage with you. If probably the biggest miracle would be people actually coming and asking, what can I do? How can I live a more energy efficient life? How can I reduce my impacts upon the planet in terms of waste, etc.? And yeah, I think people coming to you is the first step to making a real difference.
Not being afraid to ask those questions and not being afraid to not know those answers is quite important, because there's people who know more than you do, and just being able to be vulnerable and not, and yeah, like asking those questions is important.
What a great set of answers. Well done, you.
Are we done? Wow. Okay, cool. So this has been listening to Sustainable Lens on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM. This show is recorded on the 13th of February 2020. Our guests were Matt, Luke and Sylvia. Your hosts were Samuel and myself, Shane. And you can get podcasts of previous shows in sustainablelens.org, where you can subscribe on iTunes or noir.org.nz. We hope you enjoyed the show.
Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and streaming of primo local content. Download the accessmedia.nz app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.